From Westside Church in Bend, Oregon, this is Behind the Message. In this podcast, we take you behind what we teach here at Westside. I'm Ben Fleming.
And I'm Evan Earwicker. Welcome back to another episode as we talk through the Advent season. How's it going, Ben?
The Advent season, just generally?
How is Advent holding up these days?
It's great. Yeah, it's a little road weary, I'd say, is Advent.
Still popular. Still popular.
Somehow, after all this time.
Mm-hmm. Have you done the tree lighting in Rockefeller?
No. Funny story, though, over Thanksgiving, accidentally attended the Seattle Christmas tree lighting.
Oh, so, like you just walked into it?
Yeah. We were there, and we were exploring down by the waterfront-ish, and then we were taking the train from Westlake Station back to Linwood, and we got to the train station at Westlake, which is right in the middle of downtown, and heard, and the mayor is here to talk over these loudspeakers. We're like, what's going on? Around the corner. Took the corner. Huge band, the mayor spoke, and then they lit the tree and shot fireworks, and we were gone in 10 minutes. It was amazing.
That's perfect.
Everything I wanted perfect. Out of it. Yeah, no parking. We didn't hang out for an hour. It was magic.
I always think about the kind of, you know, when a tree lighting happens, it's kind of let you down a little bit because they just turn on. There's no, like, build up to it. Fireworks, you know, like, mm-hmm. they get shot off, and then you hear, you know, you see the little and then a lot of payoff there, right?
It's so exciting. Yeah, so they lit the tree, and then they had like a series of lights that went up to this like Star of Bethlehem light.
See, so they're trying to, they're addressing the same issue that I'm bringing up.
And then, yeah, all the fireworks. It was pretty great.
That's cool.
They did a really good job. And then they threw paper from the tall buildings to make you feel like it was snowing for 30 seconds.
Like confetti style or like?
Confetti style. Yeah. No, sheets of paper.
Reams of paper were thrown.
The 8x12. Is it 8x12? Is that how big?
Reams in the wrapper. Just like bricks. Merry Christmas.
How to ensure we never have a tree lighting again. Yeah, you're right, though. I've never really been excited about a tree. We go to the Sun River one a lot. Yeah. I'm sure you've been to that one.
Yeah.
A few times. It used to be the lodge lighting, which was kind of fantastic because they had so many.
Yeah.
And I think there's too much risk in that not working, so they don't do that now. They just light a tree.
They don't put themselves out there.
They don't, yeah. Really, someone should encourage them.
So we do a tree light in downtown Bend, like by the commons, right? Anybody do this?
I haven't been to the one in Bend.
No? But there is one. Yeah, we don't go. But yeah.
Lindsay hasn't been either, no?
No. There's one in Northwest Crossing, too.
Is there?
Yeah.
A lot of tree lightings. Especially for what we're saying is really not that fun of an activity. So good job, everybody. Advent's holding up.
Yeah.
That's the long story short.
And here we are 3 minutes later, still talking about tree lighting.
That's right.
No, it's good.
We can talk about part two, which you spoke, Evan, in our Advent series, The Anticipated Christ, based on, not really based on, but we are pulling from Brian Zahn's book, The Anticipated Christ, that we both love him as an author and love the material. Evan, you did something this week that I'm really curious about. So we're to have all these weeks of Advent, of course, is traditional and it's beautiful. And as teachers who do it every year, we kind of have to continue to find ways to make it feel alive. Maybe sometimes we make it feel alive a little bit more for ourselves because nobody cares quite as much as we do. And we're reliving the material so closely. But what you did, and it didn't feel gimmicky, it actually felt really informative and historical and kind of deep in the story, was you did bring in stories like Job and Joseph. Can you describe a decision to do that? I mean, outside of course it fits, but was that for you like, we really got to breathe some life into this? Or, I'll leave it to you. What inspired
you? Yeah, totally. There's a risk too when trying to involve too many narratives in a single 25-minute message, that it'll come off disjointed or scattershot or something, which there's a risk there. But I think specifically with teaching on the incarnation and Christmas, it's so familiar. We all will tune out so quickly, not because the material is, you know, unexciting. I mean, it's at the heart of our faith, right? But it's so familiar. And so, excuse me. You can only read Isaiah 7 followed by Isaiah 9 followed by Luke chapter 2 in repetition so many times before people are like, I've heard this so many times. And so for this week's message, I just felt like, how can we illuminate what Jesus came to do? His coming is often where we focus most of our attention around Christmas. That's awesome. But he came to do something. And so that's where I brought in, talked about the story of Job and how God interacts with Job back in what is likely the oldest written book in the Old Testament. And God has this very interesting respect for Job, and yet he challenges Job. And it's a very distant interaction between God and Job. And contrasting that with Mark chapter, what was it? In the book of Mark.
Yeah, right.
I think it's chapter 1. Mark chapter 1, where Jesus encounters this leper. And the leper is expecting distance. And instead, Jesus says, I want to heal you. Mm-hmm. I want to do that. And I think for us to understand that God is with us in the person of Jesus, it really helps to see the difference between before Jesus, how we thought of and interacted with God as humanity, and what it meant when Jesus walked our streets and interacted with us through his miracles and healings and the compassion that he showed in a way that was above and beyond what anyone else was willing to do. Mm-hmm. You know, and in that story in Mark, Jesus heals this leper who says, I think you can, but I'm not sure you want to. And Jesus says, I want to be healed. And then he sends him back to the priest. So go show yourself to the priest, but don't tell anybody. And even in Jesus' instructions to keep a lid on what he was capable of, we see this nature of Jesus where the miracle was for the benefit of that man in that moment. It wasn't for Jesus's platform to expand, his influence to grow, his fame to spread. All that was happening outside of, I think, anyone's control. Just word was spreading. But for these moments, Jesus is saying, I want to heal you, and it's for you. Mm-hmm. I want to do this for you. I don't want to do this so that people will know about me. You keep that quiet. This is so that you might know that you're seen and loved by God. And I think these are the things that are really the heart of the Christmas story, and that sometimes we miss if people gloss over because they feel too familiar.
Yeah, that's good. And it makes sense that the leper would feel in such a way, right? If there was any knowledge of the story of God up to that point with what they had learned, Job being a great example, God is kind of defined by distance, right? And then any closeness is actually defined by death or being too close. The glory of God with Moses, you can't see, you can't look. And I bet it would be startling for someone like the leper to then be healed and have this moment of maybe this is the God that we've been talking about. Maybe this is the Messiah. But yeah, of course it makes sense to not feel that way necessarily because, well, of course it couldn't be because our God is meant to be distant. And so the adjustment, every once in a while in the Christmas story, I try to empathize with the people that were very anti-Jesus and think, would I have been like them? Would I have thought that way? Because yeah, of course this baby in Bethlehem could not be it because the God that I know that is all powerful, that brought our fathers through all these things is a distant one. And actually I'm doing the math and saying this can't be true. And I think there's a correlation to the journey that we have as well. God can't be that close to us. It can't possibly be true.
Right.
But it is, and it takes some adjustment.
Yeah. And that adjustment, I think, is what John is writing to in John chapter 1, where he's alluding to God's presence in the book of Exodus with Moses. And he's reintroducing a lot of those themes about seeing the glory of God. Mm. But whereas Moses saw the glory of God and had to put a veil on his face, now John says, we've seen his glory up close, you know? And so we have this comparison of we have seen the same God, and yet the experience is completely different now because of Jesus. And that's all well and good. I think if you're in the first century and you've been raised on the Mosaic Law, you know, and you've gone to synagogue your whole life, in the modern day, like, what do you think the application is? What does this matter to the average American person growing up or grown up, you know, in the 20th, 21st century? What does that mean or matter?
Like, yeah.
What's the reference point that this even has any kind of impact on us? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's, so then it creates a conversation that we need to understand the Holy Spirit and the presence of God with us continued, right? Even more. So what is the Holy Spirit? What is the person of the Holy Spirit? How do we interact with that? And how comfortable can we get? So that's the the funnest part about watching the disciples interact with Jesus over the course of really just a handful of years is it's not, even though they made big faith moves to drop their nets and to leave their previous lives behind and to follow after Jesus, you see all these markers along the way of like, oh, is he really God? Is he with us? And that's our lives too, is this, okay, I'm going to put my faith in God. I'm going to walk in this direction. And then it's a lot of stopping along the way and going, I'm not sure he's still here, or that was him in the first place, right? Mm. Which actually makes me feel really comfortable and kind of tied into the writers of the Old Testament and the people that sought after God in those places, as well as the New Testament, because a lot of the story of God is a story about people being really sure and then unsure and then backtracking and then finding the way of God and then building idols. And it's comforting and distressing to see in our modern day American culture, we're doing similar things a lot of times in our lives, which means it's part of the human condition. And it means that God is redemptive even in those places. That's right. Kind of a long-winded answer, but that's my take.
And I think there's a pessimistic side that always assumes the problems we face with our faith these days in our generation are, you know, worse or bigger obstacles than anyone has ever faced, whether that be, oh, the technology today or our, you know, whatever, secularized society or the post-Christian West and, you know, all these pessimistic views on why faith and Christianity and the presence of Jesus is going to have a harder time reaching people in our generation than ever before. And what we actually find is humans are humans. Mm-hmm. And built into the good news is truth that I think works somehow in every generation. And we'll see. You know, I'm waiting for the generation where it doesn't work anymore. It just goes away. I think we have the promise that it's gonna stand the test of time. Mm-hmm. And that means these truths of God coming near to broken humanity. The packaging changes on how we understand that and the lenses that we see that through. But we believe that it still packs a punch. It still holds weight, and it still matters for people. And we see that in every service when we're talking about Jesus. You can feel the resonance in like the deep place in people's soul and experience, mm-hmm. you know?
One of the sneaky parts about your message on Sunday and about Advent as a whole is the theme of Jesus coming to conquer fear. And I had a conversation with a dad recently in which we were talking about, like a lot of dads do, kind of bemoaning this idea of social media, right? And its impacts on kids. And you talk about reading The Anxious Generation. And this is a conversation we're going to have over and over again. We're going to have it from the platform, which we have. We're going to have it with our kids, our families. And the more we talked about it, of course, I arrived at, you know, we're not really talking about social media. We're talking about fear, right? And that's what insecurity is. That's bred through our viewing everyone else's lives through these filters, is that we are missing something that everyone else has latched onto, that we aren't as good looking, that we aren't whatever. And it's fear. It's the same thing that people in these ancient times are dealing with. And of course, Jesus came and the angels came and spoke to the shepherds and said, don't be afraid. And Jesus, or God came to Mary, an angel came to Mary. I'm mixing up all these heavenly characters in this one phrase, but an angel comes to Mary and says, well, don't be afraid. And then of course, at the end of Jesus's life and his resurrection, this do not be afraid thing. And what a beautiful thing that I think can get lost in Advent a little bit. But through these stories that you brought up and mining out these different places, Isaiah is speaking to an entire nation of people that are deeply afraid that they have been completely disconnected from God. And I think maybe that's the better answer to your question. This is the tie that binds, is we are still a fearful people, afraid that we've missed out on something or we've been left behind. And this is our yearly reminder that we haven't.
Yeah. And fear sells. I mean, fear is a powerful motivator.
That's why it sticks around. Yeah.
And to make fear, you know, was it JFK? And the only thing we have to fear, FDR. Mm-hmm. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Is God, angels, FDR.
Yeah, one of them. But this idea that even in the Christmas story, fear is actually the enemy that the peace of God comes up against. Because there's always these boogeymen out there of, oh, what if this? And we sell fear as a motivator to get you to sign on to whatever the remedy is. Mm-hmm. And in the Christmas story, we find that fear itself is an enemy that is defeated by when the peace of God comes. And so that's nuanced, but I think it's really powerful that when we seek the peace of God, we are actually saying no. We're turning down the volume of our fear and replacing that with this peace that comes through trust in the God that's come close. And I think especially as fear is used, whether it be in politics or religion or wherever else, as this kind of lever to get people to respond or, you know, donate money or whatever it is, to be subversive in the way that we uphold the peace of God as a promised gift, I think it makes us unique, you know, in the world.
Yeah. Have there been some times where you've pushed back against that pretty successfully in your personal life? Like, you don't strike me as a very anxious person, but have you ever had a nice long stretch in your life where you're like, I don't know that I'm worried about anything right now. I don't know that I'm afraid of anything. I think I can think of little eras of my life, but I'm curious if you've had anything like that and what brought that on in your life.
Yeah, that's a great question, Ben. I know for me, as we've walked through serious challenges in the last years, specifically around Alyssa's health, my wife's health, it puts into perspective the things that normally I would be anxious about. And so I think that's a really natural way to realize that the things I'd normally be freaking out about, like in the grand scheme, they don't really matter. So that's actually been a helpful thing. And then you have to really wrestle with the big anxieties, you know, the big questions around future and health and all these things. And that's where I've felt a real supernatural peace, I think, come. Because those are things that you can't just be like, oh, it's no big deal. Mm-hmm. You know, this disease, is whatever, it's fine. No, it's not fine. And it's not a small deal. It's a big, huge deal. Yeah. And so to be non-anxious around the big rocks, I think, does take a work of the Holy Spirit and grace. And I'm grateful every day for that. That allows us to feel at peace. I think the side effect of that is you're just worried less about the little stuff that life throws at you.
Yeah.
You know?
Great. So the remedy is, just kidding.
Yeah, right.
Get a difficult diagnosis that you have to walk through with your spouse. Yeah, of course, that's not it, right? But I think what you're describing, and that helped get you there, is this this feeling that you're not in control of everything, right? Which leads to its own anxiety, but if handled well, that actually can be the remedy for anxiety. That this is ultimately up to God, and there's a lot of comfort in that.
Yeah.
And then some of the practices that help us get there. And I think I referenced this a little bit when I hosted this last Sunday. Christmas at its best can slow you down and help you acknowledge your environment around you to, you know, I like using the word magic around this time of year, but to kind of feel that magic moment, to hear the voice of the Holy Spirit, to slow down enough to watch the twinkle lights. And I hope that this Advent season, through teachings that we have here at Westside or time with family or whatever it might be, that is a perspective that comes in. Again, God with us means ultimately that we're not in control, that God will pull every lever necessary, including coming down and putting skin on and walking among us and dying on a cross. And there's something that should bring perspective in the middle of all that. It just takes a lot to slow down and to listen to it, right? It's funny that stopping and acknowledging the twinkle lights or the candle at the candlelight service that we're going to have stands juxtaposed to, you got to hurry up and buy all the stuff and have the most beautiful thing and make sure your travel is going on time. And so it's funny how even in this place that's supposed to slow us down, Jesus was born into a quiet place. It's kind of a noisy season, right?
Yeah. How do you handle, you're a busy guy, your family runs at a pace that even our family was like, no, we need at least a few nights at home every week. And you have just such a full schedule of sports and kids and work. And how does that fit into this you know, this call to like slow down? How do you slow down? Because I feel like my natural pace is a little bit chiller than maybe yours is. How do you keep life going and all the obligations that you have and all the sports your kids play and all that? How do you find those moments of peace in the middle of all that?
Yeah, I still have to have the regimented moments. We've talked about my walks that I go on, and that's a very important thing to me. Having a dog was really important. I read somewhere that, I think it was about fitness, but it was like people that have dogs are healthier because they blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I need an obligation to make sure that I keep moving every day. And that turned from something that's like, this is good exercise, into this is actually a spiritual moment for me. Mm-hmm. That, yeah, it's me and the dog, and it's quiet, and it's no headphones, and it's you really experience the seasons that way too, which I've actually come to really appreciate. These hot, sweaty walks in the summer, and then these ones where you have to bundle up and you feel the chill on your face. There's a God speaks to me through those things. Mm-hmm. There's a real comforting, and maybe it's just because it's on front of mind, but it is like this reminder as the seasons change for me that God is in control, that the world keeps spinning, and it's not because of my own effort. It's because of the greatness and the glory of God. But there is like, you're tapping into a conversation that I have with myself all the time that is like all at once me trying to be a good dad and tapping into my deepest insecurities. And I have a son that loves sports. I would say my experience with sports was fun, and I still am like, I feel like I missed out on like 40% of the experience from a tiny town, the resources and the coaching and the teams and whatever. And dude, I don't know if you have this with your kids, but there is this like, and it's so typical of like, I want him to have everything I didn't have. and I think he's better than me, yeah. and all this stuff. And so I am weighing that thing that exists in a lot of us of like, I want to provide something beautiful for my kids. And I think I can honestly say, if that was sports or art or whatever it's going to be, I would go out of my way to create that for them. To weigh that up against teaching them and myself that there's a healthy way to go about all this, and mm-hmm. to go breakneck into every single interest or passion just because you can isn't necessary. But we're all prone to that, because I find myself, you look at me and say, man, you guys are busy and this is all. And then I'm looking at the next group that's traveling to Seattle for practices. You know what I mean? And I'm going, wow, how did we get here? And it's fear for me. It is. I could see myself doing all kinds of ridiculous things because of fear that my kids are not going to get opportunities that I always wished I had, or because I don't want to miss out on what everybody else is doing. And that might be the Christmas thing more than anything. We resign ourselves to a certain pace because everybody else is running at that one.
Yeah. The FOMO is real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and maybe what keeps me from being quite as busy is at some level, maybe a lack of some of that fear of missing out. Mm-hmm. I tend personality wise just to be like, I'm good, I'm fine. And that keeps me, I think, from being overly busy, but it also, I think, will keep me from probably some relationships and environments. So I almost have to push myself into yeah. extra environments, right? Just to make sure I'm still connecting and I'm still reaching out. I'm still meeting new people and having new experiences. 'Cause I'll tend to kind of just get on autopilot, yeah. you know, and years will go by. I'm like, man, what happened? Like, it went too quick. Okay, well, let's slow it down. Let's have some new experiences and meet some new people.
But it's funny because I see people like you and I go, man, they're so wise. Look at them. Look at how like quiet they are. Yeah. And they don't have to rush. They don't, what is it? Twirl or spin? Is that how Jesus yeah, describes yeah. flowers? They don't twirl or spin. And I feel like I twirl and spin yeah. all the time.
I'm just a daisy in the field.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, whatever. So speaking of, peace and anxiety. Yesterday in our first service, we had some technical issues. So this is kind of funny because it's the candle of peace, right? So,
was it really?
Yeah. So Pastor Candace goes up onto the stage to light the candle of peace. And what was it? Something was wrong with the lighter.
It was tricky. It was a tricky lighter. Mm-hmm.
So it's like, welcome to the service of peace. The lighter doesn't work. Our audio on the video didn't work. And then because of that, I was supposed to come up and preach, but there was supposed to be a video there. So you get stuck on stage, like filling time, wondering where I'm at, while I'm upstairs trying to help our tech team with Justin, who's in the room, who actually had the right idea. I was, I think, hurting the efforts upstairs. But I hear you from the booth upstairs basically being like, and at some point, Evan's going to come out here, I hope. And so started the message first service yesterday, probably the most stressed I've been, you know, in
breathing
a long
hard.
Time. And it's like, oh, shouldn't have run downstairs. Oh, God is with us. Isn't that great? But man, it sure felt like
it was the devil's day, you know?
Totally.
So dumb.
Oh my gosh.
But it is funny how sometimes you have like what we're trying to portray as mm-hmm. like the candle of peace and everything seems like it's working against that. And that's a good, you know, example of how life works, right? Mm-hmm. The more we try to lean into this, we're going to have the most mindful, peaceful life, and real life doesn't always allow us
and
that.
And even more of like a perfect example, because I think my natural tendency is to be like, well, who messed up? You know, what's going on? Not that these guys in the room can affirm I'm not like a grumpy boss that's looking to chop heads off or anything like that. But like, yeah, well, I think the idea, the reason I would ask that question is because I like the idea that we could have controlled that mm-hmm. and fixed it if we just knew about it. And then I talked to Justin. He's like, yeah, software crashed. What are you going to do? Yeah. And I'm like, no, that's not acceptable. And that, my gosh, that is life. That's the worst part. And I think it's the reason why human beings are so prone to conspiracy and kind of these weird fixes, is because it's okay. It's one thing if something goes wrong. It's another thing if something goes wrong and I had zero shot of ever fixing mm-hmm. it or discovering it or finding out about it, that it was just something that was going to happen. And that happens in my life all the time. Where I could have fixed that, or we should have known, and we heap this kind of shame on ourselves, and the software just crashed. The thing yeah. went wrong. It was difficult, and now we do get to deal with the fallout or whatever the result of that is. But well, I guess what I'm trying to say is that peace isn't understanding how everything works and then preventing it before a problem happens. It's how we function after the chaos of the lyrics not popping up on a brand new song and the volume not working and the diagnosis and the bad financial decision that you made. You know, it's peace happens with that stuff, not always opposed to that stuff.
Interesting that you bring up our tendency towards conspiracy to explain things that we want someone to blame for or some you know, it just would be so nice if there was some nefarious plot under the surface that is responsible for all the problems that we face in our world, our culture, our families. And oftentimes, I think the truth is that it's not a conspiracy, right? Mm-hmm. Alyssa and I were just talking about this morning. Oftentimes, we as Christians are uniquely susceptible to conspiracy theories and going down that route, I think, because A, we're part of a faith that believes in what we can't see, mm-hmm. that's baked in, right? We like this idea of knowing what is unknown and like this special wisdom that comes from God. And all these things are good, but they can like devolve into this hunting out conspiracies. And I think it's a real danger for people of faith not to go down the wrong road and find themselves kind of surrounded by these, you know, looking for a boogeyman and someone to blame under every rock.
Yeah, for sure. And then this funny next section of things is that these conspiracies can create community.
Yeah, sure.
And a lot of times it's a group of people. I think I saw some, anyway, we don't need to go all the way into that, but people create community around this being like, something must be working against us. It can't be that I just ended up here, right? Something's actively against me. Otherwise I would be the cool kid or the rich person or the successful, whatever. I wouldn't have lost that job. I wouldn't have, but something is going against me. And it's a lot more comforting to feel that, either that I can fix something or that something's actively against me. And this isn't how it just happens. But I do think things happen sometimes. And yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's something God is giving us to handle, or maybe it's, I gotta be honest, I don't know how or when all that stuff works. And I don't know that we're called to know all of it. I think it's the peace, to bring it back, is we're called to the peace that happens in all of the circumstances and not necessarily to the answers to all of our theories.
Right. Yeah. And there's very real, you know, Ephesians 6, you know, our wrestle is against principalities and powers. There's aspects to this idea that we do have an enemy. I mean, that is right there in the text. I think the problem is when we try to apply that us and them mentality against other people and say, well, they are the enemy, that it starts to take on this really dark thing where you have communities that turn into really cults, right? Of just looking for an enemy wherever they can find it. And then once they identify that, it can be pretty dark. And so I think we have a responsibility when we talk about the peace of God and the peace that he brings, it's to correctly identify who the enemy is mm-hmm. and not allow us to point fingers at others and say, well, they are the other. They're the problem. We're going to go after them. The peace of God comes to remind us that, you know, God so loved the whole world. That's why he came. That's the incarnation is Jesus coming to save the whole world. And so part of that is to realize, like, other groups of people are not my spiritual enemy. Mm-hmm. They're people that Jesus loved. And you've talked about that we're all in the image of God, right?
Yeah, to Jesus came in this arrival that we're talking about right now is significant of the conquering of sin and death mm-hmm. and not a certain government or a certain group of people, which is such a tough thing again for us to wrap our minds around because we can't see into that. And so it's preferable to say, no, these are evil people instead of this is an evil thing that has been done, or even to see the evil in our own hearts and minds, right? And maybe it's just, I'm starting to believe for me, reflection is the biggest thing that's a part of this season. And between some of our vacations and then just some of the more poignant moments that we get to receive from, I don't know about you guys, but the candle lighting with Silent Night at the end of our Christmas Eve service is something that I've done how many years in a row in my life? Makes me cry at half of our services, at least, and especially when I'm with my kids. There's so many moments that are built in to what we do that should slow us down into this reflective place. And I think that's where peace comes from. That's where that perspective that you said you got from a really difficult circumstance with Alyssa comes from. It's that slowing down and that pulling back and allowing God to do his thing.
And I think for me, as I've gotten older, I tend to kind of callous over on how sensitive I am to, you know, those moments of beauty or being deeply moved by, in spiritual spaces and family spaces. Mm-hmm. And, that's something I got to wrestle with. Like, I don't want to be, grow old in it. In the way that I'm no longer able to feel and experience God's presence around me or the beauty of family or whatever that may be. Mm-hmm. I think that's a danger for everybody, right? That we all have to grow old in age, but we don't have to grow old in the way that we experience these moments.
A danger for us on Christmas Eve. How many years have all of us collectively been working on Christmas Eve deep into the night, right?
Yeah.
We see that evening a little bit different than most.
After, you know, six services with overflows, you're like, oh, it's magical.
Yes. Silent night, holy night, all's calm, all's let's go.
By about the third, all you're thinking about is the wax dripping onto the floor. You're not thinking about the beauty of the candle anymore.
You guys, everybody that's listening, the amount of time we spend talking about wax before and after Christmas Eve services is an embarrassing number. As somebody that works with facilities, I guess it's probably me more than anybody else. Don't flick your candles right after you blow them out. Don't be doing that. You're going to rain wax everywhere.
Yeah, I think of the mess my kids will make with just, you know, a candle or two candles at the dinner table in a single night. You multiply that by several thousand people, mm-hmm. that's a lot of wax in a small space.
And we don't give kids candles, but, you know, the parents just hand them right over.
They take the candles.
They trade the candy cane for the candles.
Yeah, they do.
How about you, Lindsay? Christmas Eve, magical still? You're one of the busiest people on December 24.
If I'm being honest, Christmas Eve is not magical, but mm-hmm. Christmas Day is. Christmas Day is very magical. Christmas Eve is a work day, if I'm being honest. And there are magical moments, for mm-hmm. sure. The candle lighting during, you know, services, seeing families together, that's really beautiful. Seeing my kids in the congregation with, you know, their dad, my husband, very magical. But I think that's okay. I think it can look different for everyone. And I think the season is still very magical. And I enjoy being a part of the magic for other people. But for me, it happens a little differently just because of the nature of my job.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's probably true every week for us who, you know, mm-hmm. Run these services mm-hmm. and minister in these services. Staying present in that in a way that we're experiencing it in real time, I think is a challenge because mm-hmm. After how many decades of leading and pastoring and leading worship and all this, to try to genuinely connect in those moments can be challenging, because we can just lead. We don't need to be like emotionally present to do this.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But I think when I take the time to enter into a service really prayerfully, mm-hmm. to actually experience the worship and worship along with the congregation rather than just being like in the room, mm-hmm. and just thinking through the next moments or whatever. I don't know. It feels like time well spent to try to just be there with the church, mm-hmm. experience it. But it's a challenge because we also have a job to do. And like, we can't just close our eyes and forget where we're at. And they're like, somebody going to preach today? Somebody going to lead worship?
Well, the flip side of that is I think of myself and I think of Steve Mickle, who our response when we feel something, when we feel the presence of God, when we feel a move of the Holy Spirit, is immediate emotion. I'm speaking for Steve. I think mm-hmm. he would agree with me. But for me especially.
We speak for Steve all the time.
I cannot sing and cry. Like, mm-hmm. you guys don't want to hear that. Yeah. It sounds awful. And so I have to be aware there's a balance. Like, it would be very easy for me to engage in worship. But by doing that, I honestly believe I'm failing to lead. Mm-hmm. So it's a line to walk where, yes, of course, we're worshiping the Lord while we're singing these songs. But I have to remember, you know, I'm a pastor in that moment and consider the congregation and walk that line. And there are times I lose it and there have been times I can't get it back. So I have to be really careful navigating that, you know, with our church.
And yeah. What an honor it is to do this timeless thing. Mm-hmm. And not only do you think back of all the congregations, people that have gathered on December 24th and celebrated like we're about to celebrate, but you think about the leaders and the pastors and the priests and the clergy that have done so also. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, there is a feeling of certainly busyness. And we were even talking about timelines today of you and I are each going to preach 10 minutes and we're going to swap sides. One will be in the student center after we speak and then one will be back in the worship center. And there's a lot of details, but the holiness of somebody had to do this and create the table for people to come and to sit at for the last thousands of years. What a cool thing that we get to be a part of that and we get to kind of father or mother that. It's a lot like Christmas morning, actually, where you were the kids and you got to come and partake and you woke up and you ripped open and then the parenting has its own kind of beauty, but it's in the form of now the cooking and yeah. the cleaning and the taking down of the tree after while others are playing with the presents. And there's some that we get to do in that is really sweet and wonderful. It's a different job, but it's a beautiful and worthy job.
Yeah, and the work is holy. To think that personal, emotional engagement in God's presence is the only form of spiritual sacrifice misses the whole point of, like you were saying, generations have gone before and they just showed up, mm-hmm. rain or shine, good days, bad days, experiencing loss, experiencing gain, all of that. They show up and they minister, they show up and they open up the doors of the church to the poor, and they show up and they run a soup kitchen, and they show, you know, and it's like there's a real beauty in the faithfulness of the work that I think is holy. And so maybe to let myself off the hook from what I earlier said, when we show up, whether we are fully engaging like on the emotional level or not, the fact that we got up that day and we said, I'm going to walk in my calling, mm-hmm. I think that honors God and it honors the calling.
Yeah, that's work as worship, right? Something that we've covered before, and it doesn't always come with the same amount of enthusiasm, and yet the holiness remains. And I was thinking, I don't know why I thought about this morning. I was driving to work, and I thought, my son won't ever really know who Johnny Carson is, you know, the old late night show host who... and then my mind began to wonder, like, for that time, has anyone pound for pound been more famous than that man who was getting the biggest acts, right? And the Beatles coming onto the show, I think, is still one of the most viewed television shows in the history of the world. My son, zero idea. That guy did not die that long ago. It was just a little while, and already a generation away, and I don't even have a connection with him like my father did. And again, I'm trying to practice this thing where that could feel really, really sad to me and make me feel like my life is meaningless and worthless. The other side is we're all doing this and we're all connecting and keeping this world moving. And for us, it's this church specific world. And what an honor it is to be a piece of that timeline, to create the table for however many years we will, and to bring out the candles and to light them again. What a cool thing to keep that piece going, even though the memory of it will fade relatively soon, but the tradition will go on.
Yeah. I was reading an interview with Ira Glass, host of This American Life.
Oh, I love
which
Ira
is,
Glass.
You know, a long-running radio show, but now one of the most popular podcasts in the world. Big deal.
Huge deal,
right? And they were interviewing Ira Glass and asking him, like, about his legacy. Like, do you consider your legacy? Are you thinking about your legacy and how you'll be remembered for all this work you've done? And he was very crass about it, and I won't quote him verbatim, but he was like, forget about legacy. All the work I do is for the living, and it's for right now. Uh-huh. He's like, and I will go away, and all this will be likely quickly forgotten, and that's completely fine. And I love that approach too. Sometimes we're so, and he said, you know, like if you're Barack Obama, think about your legacy. Like if you're actually a historic figure or a president or whatever, think about your legacy. But for me, we're doing the best we can for right now, and let's leave like how we'll be remembered in somebody else's hands. I think our job in the faith and in ministry, similarly, is stop worrying about how I'm perceived or how my work will continue after I'm done. Mm-hmm. And let's focus on lifting up the name of Jesus and then ministering to those in front of us now and let God handle the rest, maybe.
Yeah.
It's a better approach.
Yeah, that's really good. I love that Ira Glass said that. Even more respect. gosh. But yeah, I think in the mental health world, right, they would call it radical acceptance of all things. A lot of times that comes up in a conversation about death, or I think in our world more squarely, it's a surrender or an admittance to this greater cloud of witnesses that goes beyond us, which I love. In Hebrews names the superstars of faith, right? And then it's like, and then just this huge group of people that was also involved, and we get to be a part of that group. And the peace that comes from that. And it really is an incredible and dynamic thing for me personally, that I think maybe I passively worry about my legacy or I worry about all this kind of stuff. There is a peace that comes with that that's really wonderful.
Yeah, and a relief. I think the less centered we are in our own story, the more we can relax, and it takes the pressure off. I think me as my own main character, I'm gonna be super self-conscious and in my head, and how are people gonna think about me and all this, and those are usually the wrong questions. I think the better questions happen when we are, a supporting actor in our own story somehow, you know, and whether we put Christ at the center in our tradition, that is what we do, but you know, also our family and those that we love, that we're others focused. I think all that just makes for a better life. Like, forget about what we ought to do or morally or ethically, what we should do as far as selfishness. It's just going to make a better life when we're not at the center of our own concern, you know?
Yeah. One of the things that was brought up in the political conversation we had with Josh Butler was that bottom left quadrant, that is the quadrant of identity. And I understand and love a lot of that quadrant. But one of the main pieces, as he phrased it, was, you know, the truth comes from within our own selves individually. And I was like, ooh, nothing scares me more than having to rely on me to do that, to understand my own truth. Yikes.
Yeah.
I can't live that way. The pressure that comes from that. And I do, it turns out I do live in that way sometimes, even if it's passive. Jesus coming to earth eliminates the necessity to rely on my own self for that, which, you know, creates difficult things and frustrations in another way. But the idea that all this relies on me is, that's a daunting and difficult thing, that I need to be remembered for all of history as a shining whatever. I love that. I'm doing this for right now. Yeah. We're going to minister to the people right in front of my face.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll be forgotten, and that's great. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's probably a good way for a lot of leaders who who still maybe we feel the need to prove ourselves or, you know, build something that will stand the test of time. It's okay. You don't have to do that. Just be faithful mm-hmm. and keep showing up. Let the work be worship. I like that.
Yeah. And it does stand the test of time, but a lot of times it's in the, it's just
in the cloud of witnesses.
It's in the broth, yeah. right? Yeah. It's in the cloud of witnesses. It's yeah. all kinds of things go into making this meal and you can't really pinpoint them after yeah. enough time. After it stews long enough, yeah. you can't say that's that.
Yeah.
It's just a part of a bigger thing.
Yeah. Which, you know, you've got a good, strong Ben Fleming. I mean, Benjamin Fleming. You sound like a Celtic statesman. My strange last name. It's just, you know, I don't have any hope that people are going to look back at records and be like, that sounds like a very, very interesting person.
Memorable.
Yeah.
Ear Wicker.
Yeah, it's a very strange.
I mean, Fleming sounds like snot. Strange name. And if you really want to think about it, that was how my friends made fun of me. Like it was Hawking a loogie.
I'd take it. I'd take your last name.
Earwicker stuff.
Yeah.
Earwicker stuff. Justin's in the room. His name is McMahon. That's a man's name right there. Or a woman's. Yeah. A strong person.
It's a strong, it's a clan's name. A strong clan. Yeah. My grandfather was not born with the name. It was adopted when he was 2. His father was Garrison and was killed by a train.
Whoa.
He was crossing train in a truck, missed it, and the train ran him over. I've actually found the death certificate of my great-grandfather, Garrison.
Wow.
Yeah, very interesting. Not the actual paper, but I found it online, uh-huh. like a record of it. And his stepdad, a good man, was an earworker, so took the earworker name, but born Paul Garrison, which is... much stronger name, you know. We talked about it over the years of like as a family, like me and my brothers. If we just all change our name over,
I mean,
it's a lot of work though. Now you got kids. We're too lazy.
You should have done it before the
family
kids.
Name. Yeah, yeah. We should have.
Any famous Earwickers?
No, but so Finnegan's Wake, written by James Joyce, which Irish writer? Mm-hmm. Irish? Yeah, I'm looking at Justin McMahon. James Joyce had a character named Earwicker in Finnegan's Wake, which is a very strange book. It's not even readable, really. It doesn't follow any like norms.
Like not readable, like Moby Dick not readable, or like...
I think worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. But that's the only place it really shows up in like any kind of literature or popular culture ever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've got Ian Fleming.
Yeah.
007.
Famously.
Yeah. And then Alexander Fleming.
Who invented the...
Which was, oh my gosh, the penicillin.
Yes.
Yep. Penicillin.
Yep.
I was going to say antibiotics. Penicillin.
I think God invented antibiotics.
Yeah, that's true.
Is penicillin, is that a compound or is that something that was discovered and then like made into medicine? Does it exist in nature?
I think so. We lost Lindsay to fact check everything.
I don't know.
I think it was discovered and then turned into medicine. I don't think it's a compound.
Okay. I don't know. I don't think this podcast has any danger of becoming a medical podcast.
Yeah, probably
I don't think
not.
That's going to be our thing.
Yeah, we're a little too stumped. But genealogy, that's next. Next week on Behind the Message.
That's amazing. All right. We're going to wrap it up today. If you're still listening... we appreciate you sticking with us on this episode.
It's a fun one. We really did go all over the place in some good ways and some funny ways.
It's great. We're back for a couple more weeks of Advent as we work our way towards Christmas. We appreciate you listening here at behindthemessage.com, wherever you get your podcasts. And our sermons, of course, are at westsidechurch.org. We hope you're having a wonderful Christmas, and we'll see you next week.